All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Have to stoop down to talk into this mic. I think I'll just move it. That make a lot of noise? Sorry.
Hey, guys. So welcome to the thing here. I'm Scott. I'm in the chat room. Hey, guys. Chat room, guys. Stop by my website, scotthorton.org, and join up the chat room if you like. Got the usual suspects lurking around in there, seems like. All right. Good show for you today. Giorgio Caffiero will be back on the show. Remember him, writes for Foreign Policy and Focus. Talked all about Turkey issues on the show a couple of times, if I remember it right. He's going to be on about the situation with the Shia in Saudi Arabia. I think you'll find very interesting. Foreign Policy and Focus guy, John Pfeffer's crew. Good guy. And then our good friend, Mohammad Sahimi, Iranian expat, Ayatollah hater, and also awesome critic of America's Iran policy, professor of chemical engineering at USC in L.A., my long-lost second home. He is going to be on the show to talk about Iran's hawks. You know, whenever the American War Party is working to try to undermine, for that matter, the Israeli one, are trying to undermine America's nuclear deal with Iran, they are playing right into the hands, of course, of the very worst of the right-wing lunatics that run Iran. Because right-wing lunatics need each other. I kind of think that was the bottom line of the unfinished essay, War is the Health of the State, by Randolph Bourne, way back 100 years ago. All right. Anyway, so Sahimi, he'll be on to talk about the nuke talks and to talk about the war party. And I'm going to try to, it's a really good article. We're going to run it tomorrow on antiwar.com that he wrote here. I'm going to try to focus mostly on the Iran side of the thing. I don't mind letting him rehash the Netanyahu and John Boehner and all that part of the war party, you know, thing. But I think the point is should be focused more on the other part of his essay about how this plays into the hands of the very worst in Iranian politics as well. And then Marcy Wheeler's going to be on the show to talk about the trial of Jeffrey Sterling, a former CIA officer implicated in the scandalous Merlin program, but then who was accused and convicted under the Espionage Act of blowing the whistle on that Merlin plot to the journalist James Risen. So I think there's probably about 1,000 very important points that could be made about this trial and its aftermath and the subject matter that the whole trial surrounded with Merlin and all of this stuff. I wouldn't even know where to begin or end. But we're going to have about 20 minutes worth of Marcy making what she thinks are the most important points, including the subject of her article that we're running on antiwar.com right now. It's a salon.com piece about, well, I don't want to ruin it for you, but yeah. It's about the attempt to criminalize even the giving of a tip, an unclassified tip. So says someone in the military says, hey, you know what you really ought to look into is the procurement process around this kind of truck. Right? Nothing secret said. But that in itself, I think she's saying, it could now be considered to be criminal. So anyway, the police state is really clamping down on state secrets. Bad. They don't have a state secrets law like in England, but so they're just building a de facto one, basically. And it's going way too far very quickly. And of course, the people in the media, the leaders of the media, they're all guilty and they'll all end up being hoisted on their own petard, too. When they refuse to stick up for Julian Assange, they only stick up for Jim Risen a little bit, and only because he's Jim Risen of the freaking New York Times, man. If he was some lower reporter, they would all just completely turn their backs on him anyway. But then, you know, Just think about how much noise all journalists could make. Look at how much noise they made about the French cartoons. Think of how much noise they could have made about stop prosecuting our sources. For espionage, under the Espionage Act, as though they're agents of a foreign power. Giving American state secrets to the enemy in order to undermine the American government's position and the security of the American people, when in fact all they're doing is ratting to the people about their bosses, our supposed servants. And the wrongdoing that they're engaged in. They call that espionage? Only if the American people are the enemy. Well, I guess that's the end of that argument right there. All you need to know. All right. Well, anyway. So, man, I got so much to talk about in so little time. I'm going to have Grant Smith on. Oh, yeah. No. How much time? Oh, well, okay. That's okay. The Libya story can wait, but let me tell you about what it is. It's in the Washington Times. But it's not by Bill Gertz. So that's good. And it's called Clinton Undercut by Pentagon Congress on Libya War. Secret tapes reveal. Joint Chiefs, key lawmaker, held own talks with Muammar Gaddafi regime. And this is the most respect that Denis Kucinich has ever gotten in a Washington Times story, I can tell you that. And I have emails out. I'm trying to get him on the show for half an hour from now, basically, if I can possibly swing it. But this article is something else. If I can't get him on the show, I'm going to go ahead and, you know, go through this thing piece by piece as much as I can here. But it's amazing to me, actually. Remember yesterday, I was going to talk about Libya anyway, and then I was flipping through Twitter during the break, and there was a picture of the Challenger crew, you know, because it was the anniversary of the accidental destruction of the Challenger space shuttle back in 1984 or 6 or whatever it was. Would have been, I guess, yeah, 84, right? No, 85, maybe. Anyway, point is, I went off on my whole little soliloquy thing about how that happened, about how there were a bunch of people who knew that the rockets were dangerous and that it wasn't going to work and you can't take off in cold weather and we really wish we had a chance to redesign that thing and yada, yada, yada. But they didn't stand up for themselves. And so catastrophe took place instead. Because of the social psychology of the situation of being a contractor and a half a bureaucrat and a middle manager and just the way those relationships are ordered prevented the correct voice from speaking up. And then I was saying, I bet you that's got a lot to do with what was going on with the Libya war there, where the kinds of sort of bigger picture truths, like we were talking about on the show with David Enders and with Patrick Coburn and with Pepe Escobar and the other reporters who were covering the Libya war in 2011, that these weren't really even taking place at the White House level. That basically, by the time the information even gets to the highest levels, it's been so dumbed down and all the contrary kind of points and facts have been weeded out that basically the decision makers are deciding based on damn lies. I'm not saying they don't know they're lying, but I'm just saying, well, you understand what I mean. It's part of the structure of the thing. So, blam, out comes this story. As soon as the show's over, basically, it hits the wire at the Washington Times, this huge thing about how once Hillary decided she wanted to do a war with Libya, it was on, and how the Pentagon tried to stop her, and how Robert Gates, of course, he could have stopped her if he really put his foot down, and he didn't. He said, Mr. President, I recommend against it, but oh, okay, I guess if you want to. But it wasn't just Denis Kucinich who had his own open line trying to negotiate. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff went around Hillary Clinton and tried to negotiate an end to the Libya war, or tried to avoid it in the first place, but she outmaneuvered him in the bureaucracy. It's an incredible article. You got to read it. It's at the Washington Times today. Clinton undercut by Pentagon on Libya. Be right back.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I apologize to you guys. I got Benadryl brain so bad today. It's cedar fever like crazy. In fact, there's a genocide I could get behind. Did I say the same thing last year? Bring home all the army from all their bases everywhere in the world and set them to war against the cedar trees. What good are cedar trees? No good. They're vermin. They should be eradicated from the planet. Okay. I'm trying to fit in with the whole kill, 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 rah-rah USA thing that everybody's going with these days. And there's a genocide I could get behind, that's all. All right, anyway. Hey, guess what? On the line, I got Grant F. Smith from the Institute for Research Middle East Policy and also from Amazon.com, where he wrote probably a good third of the books they sell there, all of them about the Israel lobby and their influence in the United States, legal and illegal. Welcome back to the show. Grant, how you doing, man?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Very happy to have you back here on the show, my friend. And I was laughing this morning when I saw this this new piece. It'll be running. It may already be running on the blog at antiwar.com, and it'll be up in the news section, too, here. This news release, it's a poll. Well, you tell me. What's the poll say?
All right, well, I'm glad you're not calling it a push poll again, but it's kind of a pull poll. We did a Google consumer survey, right? And we took a story that Anti-War and a bunch of Israeli news outlets ran with a couple years ago, which was that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was involved in a smuggling ring that was illegally importing export prohibited items from the U.S., including 800 Krytrons, which can be used for triggering nuclear weapons. So we put out a one-question poll through Google Consumer Research asking the following. FBI files say Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was previously involved in illegally smuggling U.S. nuclear triggers to Israel. And then we had a bunch of questions in order of he should be allowed to visit the U.S., he should first be investigated by the FBI, he should not be investigated or visit the U.S., or whatever you want to say with an open results question. And almost 55% of the American adults surveyed said, no, if he wants to come into the U.S., he really ought to be investigated for that. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope this gets a lot of play. I hope Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post are on your email list, too.
Oh, they are. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, we've put this thing out to CNN. We've given it over to a lot of regional journalists. And it is a statistically significant poll. This isn't, this isn't some weird online poll from our website. This is actually going out through a network that is able to understand what the demographics are behind the respondents in order to get a statistically significant result. And so it was 1,507 responses, a good mix of age categories, income categories. And so I think it's interesting on two fronts. Number one, there wasn't a lot of other U.S. coverage of this finding. I mean, foreign news outlets, again, including the Israelis, were very interested in it, and they even forced the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs to issue their standard denial. And so that was interesting. And the other thing is just to see what Americans think when they actually have a little bit of, you know, bona fide, relevant information in a polling situation. So, you know, there were still a lot of people who came up with crazy answers or didn't want to respond, but it was a very interesting result in the sense that most people were saying, hey, you know, if this guy's coming to the U.S. and he wants to hype the Iranian nuclear threat, you know, maybe he ought to answer a few questions about his own past first. And I thought it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and it's an important couple of points you make there about how this isn't a poll of readers of the EarMep site and what do they think.
No.
This is a real survey by a hired out survey company that does
exactly.
this. And then the
right.
second thing, like you say, is about the people's reaction. Once that they know that there's a story here, you know, like when you talk about the media ignoring it, it would be understandable for them to ignore it if what you were saying wasn't true. Obviously,
right.
it's something that people don't know.
Right.
So you have to kind of inform them that, hey, there's credible reason to believe that this is the case. Do you think there should be some kind of investigation? You got all those bases covered. They can't criticize you and say, oh, where's he coming up with this? Because they don't want to see your documents.
Right. Well, you know, basically, Google's not going to put out a poll. They're not going to risk all of their affiliations of the news websites that actually field this in their network by putting out something that is, you know, inflammatory or wrong or, you know, discriminatory. So they vet these surveys. But, you know, you can easily find the FBI files. You can easily find Richard Kelly Smith's statements. You can find news clippings. You can find the two Israeli authors who wrote about this Project Pinto as well. So it's not like the information isn't out there. And, you know, they looked at the survey and they, you know, they ran it. So it wasn't just, you know, you can't say that this is something that doesn't have some relevance and doesn't have some vetting.
Yeah.
Not that anyone wants to be subject to, you know, gatekeepers in any sense for getting information. But there are some gatekeepers, whether it's, you know, anybody. Press release, editors at Anti-War, editors at Newsweek, you know, news gets vetted, polls get vetted. So it's an interesting process.
Yeah, competing poll companies vet each
right.
other and their statistical sampling and those kinds of things too. Friendly competition hopefully keeps us
right.
all honest. Now tell us, elaborate for the rest of the segment here, which is very short,
okay.
40 seconds, Netanyahu's role in this thing.
Well, Netanyahu's role is being an employee and coordinator from an Israeli front company, Helai Trading. He worked there and he would meet with the U.S. contact, Richard Kelly Smythe, when he went to Israel, and they were running all of these orders through a number of different companies, including Milco and Milchan Brothers, but Milco was in California, putting orders from the Ministry of Defense, Israeli Ministry of Defense, through this network to illegally procure items that they didn't want to try to attempt to ship through Israeli diplomatic pouches. And they were very successful in getting just about everything they needed until they were caught. Their American counterpart had to flee overseas. He was eventually tracked down, arrested. And before he went to jail, he blew the whistle on the entire operation.
Right. And I'm sorry. Good. It turns out we actually had a minute and 40 seconds. So now we can also
okay.
tell about your website, which is yeah. IRMEP.org for the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. Or Middle Eastern policy, and people can find all your documents on this and all the books you've written about the covert Israeli program to steal nuclear material and nuclear technology from the United States. Thank you so much for your time on the show, Grant. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
IRMEP.org, EarMep. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Giorgio Caffiero. He is the founder of Gulf State Analytics and writes for Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. John Pfeffer and the crew over there. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Giorgio?
Hey, Scott, I'm great. Thanks for having me on your show. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Really appreciate you joining us today. Very important article that you've written here, and it's something that I've seen a couple of headlines go by.
But not too many. It doesn't seem like people are paying much attention. But the way you paint this story, it's incredibly important. The article is called "The Death Sentence That Could Inflame Sectarian Tensions Across the Middle East." And it's about Sheikh, well, I'll let you say his whole name correctly and let you go from there. Please tell us the story.
Sure. Last October, a special court in Saudi Arabia sentenced a prominent Saudi Arabian Shiite cleric, Nimre al-Nimre, to death. And he was sentenced to death because of his outspoken opposition to the ruling monarchy in Saudi Arabia, its treatment of Shiite Muslims, who constitute about 15% of the kingdom's population. And Sheikh Nimre al-Nimre established himself as a very important leader in Saudi Arabia's Arab Spring that erupted in 2011 when other anti-government movements came on the scene in Egypt, Tunisia, and other countries in the region. The Shiite cleric was leading a peaceful, nonviolent movement, and the government wanted to demonstrate that it would not accept any forms of dissent among the kingdom's Shiite population. And this death sentence is sending a very strong signal, not just to Shiites in Saudi Arabia about the kingdom's firm position, but they're also sending a strong message to Iran and other Shiite actors in the region that the kingdom is not going to compromise at all in its very hardline sectarian position.
Mm-hmm. And now you're confident that this man absolutely is a peaceful protester type and that the charges against him are trumped up?
Yeah, that is definitely the understanding of many international human rights organizations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. A lot of the charges against him are very, very strange, such as waging war on God, insulting the late King Abdullah. Very, very phony charges.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now, so it's one of these quirks of history and the way things work out. And just guarantees trouble for the long term, I guess, that all the Shiites of the Arabian Peninsula apparently all live right up there in, I guess the whole thing is tilted towards the northwest, but in what I guess you'd call the northeast of the country. That's where all the oil is and where all the Shiites are, even though they're ruled by the Sunni majority and have no property right over that oil respected by the kingdom, correct?
Yes, the eastern province basically encompasses the entire eastern part of Saudi Arabia, and virtually all of Saudi Arabia's oil is situated in that area, which is equivalent to about one-fifth of the global supply of oil, and pretty much all of Saudi Arabia's Shiites live there too. So it's a very tense standoff between the Shiite opposition and the government, which is very concerned about a revolt erupting in this very strategically vital area of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And politically speaking, they're just completely on the outs and have no power or influence within the royal family, etc.?
That is certainly the case. The Shiites are excluded from positions of power within the government. They are also... For decades, they have faced discrimination in other areas, such as education. It is a consensus among analysts that the Shiites of Saudi Arabia are indeed treated as second-class citizens.
Mm-hmm. And we all saw what happened with the peaceful demonstrations, or almost, you know, virtually entirely peaceful demonstrations in Bahrain at the Pearl Roundabout there in 2011 when the Saudis just came right across the bridge to put that peaceful protest down. And then there's an entire record of the torture, even of doctors who dared to treat the wounded protesters. And I guess that clampdown continues. I don't know if the Saudi forces are still in Bahrain to that degree. I know the Americans are. But as far as the Saudis helping them repress the people of Bahrain, they sure got that work done in 2011.
Yeah, there is an important connection between the situation in the eastern province and the situation in neighboring Bahrain, just connected to the eastern province by a 16-mile causeway. Many of the Bahraini Shiites, as well as the Saudi Shiites, have expressed solidarity with one another, and they both view their own groups as dealing with a very similar plight. These are oppressed Shiites who are living under U.S.-backed Sunni monarchies, who are unwilling to allow the Shiites any sort of power in the country. And one of the main reasons why the Saudis were so quick to send their security forces into Bahrain back in 2011 is because they were concerned of the implications of a Shiite revolution in Bahrain for Saudi Arabia's own eastern province. And I actually traveled to Bahrain in August last year, and when I went to the island of Sitra, which is really the heart of this anti-government uprising in Bahrain, there were posters of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr on just walls and street corners.
And I think you say in the article, they're all painted over now, right? And the government's trying to crack down on even signs of support for them.
Oh, absolutely. The there has been some graffiti, calling for Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr to be freed. And the Bahraini authorities indeed have painted over much of that graffiti all over the walls.
And now, one thing that's really interesting that you talk about in here, Giorgio, is how partly this is just domestic politics in the kingdom, the king and his ministers protecting their right flank from those who would criticize them for stabbing ISIS in the back after helping to generate the rebellion in Syria. And now America insists they leave them high and dry, and so they're backing off their support. And so they have their right-wing critics, and so they kind of appease them by saying, okay, well, here, we'll, persecute this Shiite leader over here in our own country.
That's absolutely correct. Last fall, Saudi Arabia and three other Gulf Sunni states joined the U.S.-led military campaign against ISIS in Syria. Saudi Air Force bombed some of the ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra targets over there, and this actually led many conservative Saudis to criticize their government, because from their perspective, Saudi Arabia, by bombing a Sunni group in Syria while not attacking the Assad regime, is essentially, according to them, aligning Riyadh with Iran and Hezbollah. And the government in Saudi Arabia is very worried about more conservative elements of Saudi society becoming increasingly angry with the government. And you're absolutely right that the death sentence is sending a message to a domestic audience that while Saudi Arabia...
I'm sorry, Giorgio. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org for all the archives. I'm talking with Giorgio Caffiero, founder of Gulf State Analytics, about his piece at, you can find it at Common Dreams, and at, I think we ran it as an original on antiwar.com as well, Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. It's called The Death Sentence That Could Inflame Sectarian Tensions Across the Middle East. And it's about this Saudi Shiite Sheikh Nimr And I'm sorry about the heartbreak and the bad time in there, Giorgio, but you were just finishing up talking about how the Saudi royal family, they have political forces on their right, and that they're partly appeasing them by persecuting this guy, because at the same time, in their eyes, the Saudis are ceding the Iraqi battlefield to the Iranians at American insistence.
Absolutely.
This, I guess I should have said and or the Syrian battlefield as well there.
Right. There's definitely a perception from some Wahhabi extremist circles in Saudi Arabia that the government has become, quote unquote, soft on Shiism. And the government certainly does not want more Wahhabi Saudis to turn to ISIS or become increasingly sympathetic to ISIS. So this death sentence certainly sends a message that the government remains committed to clamping down on Shiite dissent. I think an important point to note, though, is that if the Saudi Arabian authorities were to go ahead and execute Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, there would likely be a very dangerous backlash, not only within Saudi Arabia's eastern province, but also in other countries in the region where there are large Shiite populations that revere the Shiite cleric who is now on death row.
Well, and I think you say in the article there's already been attacks in Bahrain attributed to backlash from just his sentencing, correct?
Yes. Some reports have surfaced that some Shiite militias in Bahrain have waged certain attacks and have threatened to attack U.S. Marines. Let's keep in mind that the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is based in Bahrain, so you have many U.S. military personnel in the Persian Gulf Island Kingdom, and some of these Shiite militias have also threatened Saudi nationals who they refer to as occupiers of Bahrain. And in Iraq, there are some Shiite militias, as well as in Yemen, who have stated that there will indeed be consequences for Saudi Arabia if they were to go ahead and execute the Shiite cleric.
Wow. Hey, can you tell me how this guy ranks compared to, say, the Ayatollah Sistani or somebody with a lower-level credential like Muqtada al-Sadr?
The Iranian government, media, and religious establishment call Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr an Ayatollah, messenger of God. And in Shiism, that is the highest rank for a religious authority.
So this would be like if they were to execute Sistani or to put a death sentence on Sistani. It's that level of a offense to the Shiite population.
It's an incredibly sensitive issue.
Wow.
You're absolutely right. Wow. This would really enrage many Shiites all over the world.
Wow. And, you know, it's funny. I was reminded of when I was reading your article of the WikiLeaks from the heroic Chelsea Manning doing 35 years in the brig for us right now, still, where the king says to George Bush, "I don't understand. It was always you, me, and Saddam against Iran to contain the Iranian revolution. Now you're going to give Iraq to Iran on a golden platter," he said. And so that's really, I don't know why Bush thought that the Saudis would just, I mean, obviously they had to accept the fact America was going to do the war, but they didn't necessarily have to accept the fact of the results. They've been financing the Sunni-based insurgency ever since then, really. And if they've backed off now, that would be the new news, I guess.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that the fall of Saddam was understood in Riyadh as a major loss to Iran, and the Saudis really think that the Americans made a huge blunder.
You mean a boon to Iran, a loss to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this partially explains why the Saudis were so aggressive to send their security forces into Bahrain back in 2011. And Riyadh certainly did not seek a permission slip from Washington, D.C. before doing so. In their opinion, the fall of the Sunni Khalifa family in Bahrain would constitute another country on Saudi Arabia's borders falling to supposedly pro-Iranian forces. Mm-hmm. And right now in Yemen, the Saudis are very worried about the Houthis gaining power. And in their, from their perspective, recent developments in Yemen indicate that Iran is gaining even more influence in yet another country on Saudi Arabia's borders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask you about, is the victory of the Houthis there. And I guess politically how that plays in to the situation. And I guess, in other words, the domestic politics in Saudi Arabia seem to be determining that they keep making matters worse. Or I don't know. What do you think of the chances they're actually going to carry out the beheading and crucifixion of this guy's corpse, as you say, is the sentence here?
Many experts doubt that the Saudi Arabian authorities will actually execute the cleric. Some people have said that the Saudis often like to show the sword without having to use it. It's just a matter of speculation, but given all the security risks associated with the execution of this cleric, I think it's very possible that the Saudis are just trying to send a message, and I would be surprised if they actually executed the cleric, but these things are very difficult to predict.
Mm-hmm. Now, to what degree is Iran really behind the Houthis? I mean, they must be sending them some money and guns, but if you listen to Charles Kruthammer, this is the rise of the Iranian Empire, and not because he lied us into war with Iraq. Never mind that.
Yeah. Listen, the Houthis practice a form of Shia Islam, and like most Arab Shiites, they do have a connection with the Islamic Republic of Iran. There are links between the Iranian regime and the Houthis. Yet at the same time, it's important for your viewers to understand that Yemen is the poorest Arab country, and a lot of the people fighting in Yemen will accept money from anyone. And just because the Houthis have maybe taken some money, possibly some arms from Tehran, does not mean that they are a proxy of Iran. The relationship between the Houthis and Iran, for example, is very different than the relationship between Lebanese Hezbollah and Iran. And at the same time, given the fact that the Houthis are dealing with many legitimate local grievances, I don't believe that Iran is the reason why they waged a rebellion against the U.S.-backed government in Sana'a. Even if the Islamic Republic of Iran had no relationship with the Houthis, there's still reason to believe that this uprising would have occurred. Now, there are many neoconservatives who have their ulterior motives with Iran and have an interest in making people think that the Houthis are an agent of Iran, and they would like people to think that Iran orchestrated a coup against a U.S.-backed government in Yemen to use this as further, justification for ending the nuclear negotiations with Iran. So, as I said, there are plenty of people in Washington, D.C. with ulterior motives who are inaccurately representing events in Yemen.
And Giorgio, I'm sorry, I just remembered that you're in a hurry and need to go, so I'll let you go right now.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I hope we can do this again sometime soon.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. It's been great.
Hey, thank you so much, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's Giorgio Caffiero. And again, I'm sorry about the timing there, man. I totally forgot it was supposed to just be one segment. Giorgio Caffiero, find it at commondreams@antiwar.com, at FPIF.org. It's called The Death Sentence That Could Inflame Sectarian Tensions Across the Middle East. And then, you know, what I was going to ask him was going to be along the lines of, do you think that, doesn't sound like he would have had much time anyway. I hear drums. I was going to ask him whether he thinks the Saudis have really quit financing the rebellion in Syria, whether he thinks they're financing Al-Qaeda fighters in Yemen against the Houthis, but I guess that one will have to wait for his next article. Mohammed Sahimi on the nuclear program right after this. Actually, on the Iranian hawks on the nuclear program right after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com.
Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Stop by there, click on things. Coming up, the heroic Marcy Wheeler. But first, the great Mohamed Sahimi. He teaches chemical engineering at USC. He's an Iranian expat and an expert on their nuclear program, as well as all the American and international politics surrounding it. You can find a great many of his articles at antiwar.com, including this one that'll be running tomorrow. Washington's Iran hawks provide ammunition for Tehran's hawks. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me in your program again, Scott.
Very good to talk to you again, and happy to give you a chance to explain the points you're trying to get at here in this article to my audience. I think they're very important. I guess, first of all, it's worthwhile to let you go ahead and give a rundown on the Washington Hawks and what exactly it is they're doing that is providing ammunition for Iran's.
Well, the point I've been trying to make over the past a year and a half is that it is not just Washington that has hawks that want to prevent any agreement between Iran and P5+1 over Iran's nuclear program. And the fact that Tehran itself also has hawks and hardliners who also don't want any agreement with Iran, with the U.S. So when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was Iranian president, he had a hardline policy, and that basically contributed, although it wasn't the prime contributor, but it contributed to the fact that nuclear negotiations didn't go too far. Then Hassan Rouhani was elected as Iranian president, and given his long experience in national security issues and the fact that he was former chief nuclear negotiator, and during his tenure as chief nuclear negotiator, he had pursued a totally moderate and reasonable approach to resolve the issue over Iran's nuclear program. The hope was that he could do the same as president, and in fact, he has done the same thing. He has used the same approach, and his foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who's a very skilled and polished diplomat, has been negotiating with 5+1, as everybody knows. And, of course, the negotiations have made some progress. Iran has received a little bit of relief from sanctions. In return, Iran has made major concessions that I have discussed these in your past programs. But now, as we approach the deadline for reaching an agreement, and as report indicates that some progress has been made, Washington hawks don't want any agreement with Iran. So they have been trying to do their best to prevent it. So not only they are trying to prevent that, but in my opinion, they are also providing justification for Tehran's hardliners to try to topple Rouhani administration and replace it with a hardline president, just like Ahmadinejad, which, if that happens, then the two countries may move on a path towards war. So on the Iran side, when Zarif met with John Kerry, Secretary of State, they had several meetings over the past few weeks, and they also, as part of the negotiation in Geneva, they took a walk around the streets of Geneva, and that provided an excuse for Tehran hardliners that why you did this. This indicates that you are very friendly towards the West and things of that sort. Okay, but this was basically their main problem with what Zarif had done. Now, on the other side, of course, as I discussed in the article, there have been efforts on all sides to prevent an agreement with Iran. First, for example, we know, first of all, that Robert Menendez and Mark Kirk introduced a resolution in the Senate to vote for new sanctions against Iran, although it seems like Menendez has backtracked. He and other senators yesterday sent a letter to President Obama saying that they are going to postpone it. Then Republicans are also trying to pass another resolution demanding that if Iran and the United States reach any agreement, that agreement should be put up for a vote in both Congress and Senate. And given that Congress and Senate are completely pro-Israel, we know that what might happen if that's done. But, of course, we all know that John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, invited Benjamin Netanyahu to come to Congress and give a speech to a joint session of the Congress, basically to rebut what the president said in his State of Union address, saying that if they pass any resolution imposing new sanctions on Iran, he will veto it, and saying that you know, Iran and the U.S. have an opportunity to resolve this difficult problem, and the Congress should not do anything that would impede the progress. And of course, that has provoked wide reaction and wide criticism. Some people call John Boehner American traitor. Justin Raimondo of Anti-War called him basically Israel's fifth column. I think all of them are fitting and appropriate. Then we had Senator Lindsey Graham, who went to Israel and basically told Netanyahu that when it comes to Iran, Israel and Netanyahu should lead the way and Congress will follow them. Basically, he was telling that Mr. Netanyahu should decide for U.S. Congress what it should do regarding Iran. He had also called for massive military attacks against Iran back in 2010. So when you put all of this together, we will see, you know, how pro-Israel this guy is. And, of course, as I pointed out in my article, he's from South Carolina. Most white voters in South Carolina are Christian Zionists, and Christian Zionists support Israel ardently. And therefore, Graham, whether he believes it or not, he must pander to them, and that explains what he has done. But the most interesting about this guy is that how out of touch the guy is, because after Islamic State took a lot of territory in Iraq several months ago, the same Senator Graham that has called for massive attack against Iran and asked Netanyahu to lead the way and tell Congress how to conduct U.S. policy regarding Iran called for cooperation with Iran so that they can defeat the Islamic State. So apparently he believes that the U.S. can go and destroy Iran's military and nuclear infrastructure and the country's infrastructure, kill tens of thousands of Iranians, but in return for quote-unquote favor, Iranians will spill their blood so that Mr. Graham and senators like him ambitions in Middle East, which are basically, in my opinion, imperialist ambition, can advance. Then we had the articles by Dennis Ross, Eric Edelman, and Ray Takieh, and these guys also testified in the Senate the other day, saying that negotiations with Iran has stopped. I mean, nobody believes that the negotiations have stopped. In fact, both sides say that negotiations have progressed. If it has stalled, that means that there was a deadlock. There was nothing to talk about. There would have been no Geneva Agreement, and so on and so forth. But these guys say the negotiations have started, which means that the Obama administration should take a tougher line. So they say that the administration should take it to Tehran, and they say that the president needs to have a tougher coercive policy to force Iran to make concessions. As I have explained in my articles in the past, including those that I have posted on Anti-War, Iran has actually made all the necessary concessions. Iran has limited its nuclear program. Iran has stopped enriching uranium at 20%. Iran has agreed to limit the number of centrifuges. Iran has agreed to transform the Fordow enrichment facility built under a mountain to a research facility. Iran has agreed to redesign the nuclear research reactor in Arak so that it won't produce as much plutonium. And Iran has agreed not to enrich uranium at 5%. These are all the concessions that one needs if they are really serious about reaching an agreement with Iran. So the saying that the negotiations have stalled is totally wrong, in my opinion.
All right, we got to hold it right there, Mohammed. Did I tell y'all he was great or what? We'll be right back with more Mohammed Sahimi. Antiwar.com tomorrow will be running this latest piece on American hawks helping the Iranian hawks to try to sabotage the nuke deal. The nuclear. I didn't mean weapons. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Mohammed Sahimi. We're talking about Washington's hawks, which is interchangeable with Tel Aviv's, and what they are doing that is inadvertently or just advertently, is that a word, empowering the hawks in Iran. So, we got a good rap from you there about Netanyahu. As you say, it's probably the first time in history that the speaker of any parliament ever brought a foreign leader to speak to denounce the policy of the executive. I think you're probably right about that. If anybody else knows any other examples, please let us know. But then, of course, as you said, the sanctions that have now been delayed temporarily, the threat of an up or down vote, and, of course, all the propaganda about Iran unceasingly by the war party trying to end the negotiations, trying to pretend that Obama's selling out and weakness to Iran and letting them run roughshod all over them, when really what they're demanding is, as you say in the article, completely impossible, and no one is really no one is honest and says that, yeah, we expect to be able to negotiate Iran right out of their nuclear program entirely.
There is no way.
Only liars, pretend that that's even achievable at all. And what they mean is sabotage. But now, okay, so you can comment on that if you want. But then please tell us all about the Iranian hawks. I want to learn as much as I can about the position of the Majis, which is, I guess, the House of Lords over there. Is that how it works? The Revolutionary Guard Corps and all of these guys and their position, their stake in this matter.
Oh, they do have a big stake in this matter. And as I explained in the article, the Iran's hardliners are basically of two groups. One of the groups are old revolutionaries. These people believe that no matter what Iran does, the U.S. will always find another excuse to come after Iran, because the U.S. has never been happy about the fact that the revolution toppled a U.S. staunch ally, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, in Iran in 1979. It never recognized the legitimacy of the revolution, and therefore, even if Iran and U.S. reach an agreement over Iran's nuclear program, U.S. will find another excuse, such as, for example, human rights or something like that. So they oppose any agreement with U.S. on ideological ground and the fact that they are suspicious of the U.S. And to be honest, even though I totally oppose these hardliners, I think they do have a point. The U.S. has been trying to do all sorts of things to Iran over the past 35 years. But I don't agree with their approach that in order to handle the issue, we must block a nuclear agreement with the U.S. But the biggest group of hardliners in Tehran that oppose a nuclear agreement with Tehran are those that are connected to intelligence security forces, a part of the Revolutionary Guards, and supporters of the regime, and hardline clerics. These people have benefited tremendously from economic sanctions imposed on Iran. In fact, when the economic sanctions began to be imposed on Iran a few years ago, people like me wrote many, many articles saying that these sanctions only hurt ordinary Iranians and benefit the hardliners. So don't do this. Don't impose economic sanctions. This is not the way to do it. So these hardliners created a black market for all sorts of things because of the sanctions, and enriched themselves tremendously and then use part of that wealth to also get more and more political power, to the point that the last 4 years of Ahmadinejad's presidency was probably one of the most repressive, politically repressive era in Iran's contemporary history. Now, they feel that if Iran and Faiz Dostan, and in particular if Iran and the U.S. reach an agreement, first of all, the economic sanctions will be lifted or at least suspended, and that opens up the country to foreign investors, foreign technology, and so on. There won't be any black market because Iran will be able to import what it needs freely and through the normal ways. The oil industry that the Revolutionary Guard related or linked companies have been trying to run because of the economic sanction will not be controlled by them anymore, because foreign oil companies will come in and they have the modern technology, and the Revolutionary Guard companies cannot compete with them, and therefore they have to get out of it. And all sorts of things. And of course, if the economic situation improves, that means that the political atmosphere should also open up, because once people are not worried about their economic plight, they start talking about their rights as citizens and so on. So that opens up their political space also, and that provides an opportunity for democratic groups in Iran to make their voice louder. And also, the fact that Iran and the U.S. reach an agreement means that the hardliners can no longer sell the United States as a threat to Iran's national security, and therefore they cannot, for example, jail their opponents under the guise that there's a threat to national security. So if you look at it from any direction, reaching an agreement with the moderate, pragmatic government of Hassan Rouhani is not only in the interest of Iranian people, but also in the interest of the West and the United States, because we have an important country like Iran with its strategic position, vast natural resources, very educated and young population, which is generally pro-West, and this country is improving economically, is opening up the political space, and that becomes a model of stability and some sort of progress in the Middle East, where the rest of the Middle East is up in the fire and war is going everywhere, bloodshed is going on everywhere. So if we really are thinking about the true national interest of the United States, we should actually support an agreement with Iran rather than oppose it. Mm-hmm. But of course, these hardliners don't want that because they have also their own vested interests. And one of the points that I want to mention is, if we have time, and emphasize that, is that one of the worst aspects of this is that some of these people who oppose agreement with Iran also support the Mujahideen Khalq organization, the MEK organization. This is a terrorist organization that was even listed as a terrorist organization by the State Department up until September of 2012. This is an organization that carried out many terrorist attacks in Iran in the 1980s. According to their own leaders, they killed 57,000 Iranian soldiers during the Iran-Iraq war at the front between Iran and Iraq. It collaborated with Saddam Hussein regime during the Iran-Iraq war.
Well, very quickly here, they have no support in Iran is the point.
Absolutely support. But, and yet these people support MEK and oppose a nuclear agreement with Iran.
Right. And now, so one thing, because I think you did a great job. Well, everybody, live audience, will be interrupted here, but I'm going to keep recording him a minute into the break so you can catch the archive later. And then on the other side of the break, we'll have Marcy Wheeler for you here. On the MEK, everybody, go back, check the archives, read up on MEK, read Mohammed Sahimi, listen to our previous interviews about it, et cetera. Very important point there that you make. But I wanted to get to sort of the opposite of what you were saying, or not really the opposite, but where you're describing all the benefits to the Hawks from the continuing of the Cold War. I wonder what you think would happen to Rouhani and his more moderate faction if they were to fail in these talks.
Oh, if they fail, then obviously he will be replaced by a hardliner. And the hardliner that who would replace him would be even worse than Ahmadinejad. In fact, both Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif have emphasized that Iran has important elections a year from now. And if these negotiations fail, and if they cannot deliver the benefits of an agreement to Iranian people that, you know, would lift economic sanctions and so on, then in next year's elections for Iranian parliament, the Haradinaj will take total control of it and will use that to impeach the president and remove him from office. And if that happens, God forbid, then somebody much worse than Ahmadinejad would come to power. And that would take Iran towards a total confrontation with the United States. And that's not what we want. At the time when Middle East is in fire and bloodshed is everywhere, we don't want another war. But to prevent that, and we can prevent it because the supreme leader, Iranian supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, has control over these hardliners as long as he supports the negotiations with the hope that an agreement can be reached, those hardliners can be controlled. But if he decides that these negotiations are not going anywhere and the U.S. and its allies are asking basically Iran to surrender rather than reaching a reasonable agreement, then he will withdraw his support. And if he does that, then what I described to you will most likely happen. Yeah. So in my view, even in that case, the responsible party would be Washington House, because Rouhani and his team are doing their best to make the necessary concessions to convince Khamenei that this is useful and this is the path they should take. And so far, they have had his support. So if Washington House prevent an agreement, they be responsible for all the consequences of not reaching an agreement with Iran.
Yeah. Well, everybody read this piece. It'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow because there's so many great points in here that need to be elaborated on that we didn't get to talk about, especially the very conclusion there. I'll leave them wanting. It's Mohammed Sahimi's at antiwar.com. Washington's Iran hawks are providing ammunition for Tehran's hawks. Thanks very much for your time, Mohammed. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
And we'll be right back with Marcy Wheeler in just a sec. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Marcy Wheeler on the line. She's Empty Wheel in the blogosphere, emptywheel.net, and at Empty Wheel on Twitter. Welcome back to the show. Marcy, how are you?
Good. Yourself?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. Great piece here at Salon.com, and you've written quite a few for different places over the past couple of weeks here on the Jeffrey Sterling trial. This one is called "This Is How a Police State Protects Secrets." So I guess, first of all, sum it up for us. Who's Jeffrey Sterling, and what's all the hubbub?
Well, I'm going to say, first of all, I never pick my own salon headlines, so I wouldn't have been as alarmist. But Jeffrey Sterling is a former CIA officer who just got convicted on 9 charges, mostly espionage, for purportedly leaking details of an operation, of a kind of dicey operation to deal nuclear blueprints to Iran in 2000.
All right, and now, well, it wasn't exactly nuclear blueprints, but the fire set for some nuclear blueprints anyway, I guess, but
right.
Kind of an important point. All right. So now you make the case in here, and I was keeping up. We were reposting everything that Norman Solomon was writing and Ray McGovern and Gareth, who also covered the trial at antiwar.com about it. And you seem to agree with what I had gleaned from all that reporting, which was that the government never really came anywhere near proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Jeffrey Sterling even was responsible for this leak to James Risen.
Look, I'm not going to double think the jury on most of these counts. I think I can understand them finding him guilty for the later, for basically being involved in Risen's book. I don't think I would have, but then I come in with a lot of information that the jury doesn't have. I know, for example, that some of the key witnesses against Sterling have themselves done what DOJ pointed to prove that he brings classified documents home. So have many of the witnesses against Sterling. Jury didn't learn that. And so there's a lot of stuff like that that I know, and it makes me more predisposed to think that the government is screwy, but whatever, I'm not a juror. There is one count where I just don't understand, and that's that they found him guilty of obstructing justice for deleting an email in 2006 that he had sent Rice in 2003, basically saying, I'm worried about Iran getting nukes. And that's what the CNN article that he linked in that email was about. And the only action that happened in Missouri. So, you know, that's actually the charge that I might be most quick to find Sterling guilty of, except that it shouldn't be charged in Virginia. It happened in Missouri. None of it happened in Virginia. The jurors asked for instructions on that count in particular, and they nevertheless still found him guilty on that count. And that's the one I was really shocked by. But it does suggest to me that there may have been some confusion on the instructions that the jury got, at least as that count.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it's a circumstantial case, and I guess reasonable doubt is a matter of quality and not a math problem. So it's sort of up to what the jury thinks, and they went for it. But now there have been, not just in your article here, and you got some, but all over the place, there have been all kinds of speculations about further chilling effects and implications for journalists, for journalist sources of all different descriptions. What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, Eric Holder did his little victory lap saying, look, woohoo, we can go ahead and convict people without hearing from reporters. And really what he's celebrating is that a jury, that security theater works with juries. I mean, they basically, the whole thing, you know, the CIA witnesses, some of whom aren't technically classified identities, testified behind this big wall, so we couldn't see them. The most ridiculous part of security theater is when the government handed the jury these three documents in bright red secret folders, didn't let them read them exactly. But it turns out, A, they were probably retroactively classified secret. They probably weren't secret when the government seized them from Jeffrey Sterling's house in October of 2006. But more importantly, they were about how to dial a rotary phone. Right. So the CIA wants us to believe that how they dial into the CIA using rotary phones in 1987 is something that is so secret it has to be kept in special folders and only glimpsed closely, barely. Right. And so it's that kind of security theater that I think really worked in the government's favor. But it was just ridiculous. It was just absurdity.
That's funny. Yeah, it seems like that would be absurd to the jurors. That, wait a minute. This is how desperate they are to nail this guy. Is they're saying he has some old rotary phone instructions laying around his house that clearly doesn't amount to anything. I mean, it sounds as ridiculous to me as it obviously does to you, but works with the jury every time, I guess.
Well, and the other thing is that you and I know how the government tried to prosecute Thomas Drake, again, with retroactively classifying documents and then saying, oh, you've got this document we now say is secret. Mm-hmm. In your basement, that the IG told you to keep in your basement, and therefore that proves you're a big leaker.
Defense have no ability to prove that part of it, that, hey, you guys, it wasn't even secret back when you found it?
Actually, these three documents were entered under the silent witness rule, so the defense wasn't supposed to be able to ask questions on cross altogether. Now, they did. The prosecution objected, so the jury wasn't allowed to consider what the defense objected. But that's how I know it's about rotary phones. And I think that they did this silent witness BS, if you could use my French, to avoid happening what happened in the Drake case, which is that, in the Drake case, they brought in Bill Leonard, who was the expert for all classification in the government until basically David Addington chased him out. I think it was 2007, to come in and say this is not classified. And I think that you could easily get Bill Leonard to do the same in this case. And then the only proof you have that Jeffrey Sterling brought classified documents home goes out the window. Mm-hmm. Instead, they brought, I don't know if you've ever FOIA'd CIA, but the woman who always writes these declarations about how secret stuff is for CIA FOIAs, they brought her on a stand, and she said, oh, very secret. And it was clear she was making stuff up, as she always does in FOIA declarations. But she did on the stand under sworn testimony. You know, this is CIA's own judicial district, and they get away with stuff. And that's why it was charged in Virginia rather than Missouri, where it would make more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they get away with it.
And you're saying that they kept it from the jury, that the witnesses who were testifying against Sterling also had classified information at their house, which might give them the idea that, oh, come on, CIA guys always have a couple of classified things laying around here or there, big deal. It's not a crime unless they're already trying to crucify you for something else.
Right, and the other thing is that the CIA purportedly kept this from DOJ up until this, like, literally hours before Sterling's trial was supposed to start in 2011. And Leonie Brinkham, the judge in the case, wrote an opinion about what the defense would be able to get out of this back in December, but it's still classified. All I know is that when the first of what are probably these witnesses testified, she interrupted and said, this is the first witness, and they went into bench conference. And I suspect that's when she said, screw it, you're not allowed to tell the jury that this guy brought stuff home as well. And the key part is, the key witness was this guy, Bob S., who was in charge of, he's now a contractor, but he was in charge of the counterproliferation department then. And some of his testimony was outright conflicted with the cables that were in front of his face. So I don't think he was a particularly good witness, but I've had a lot more time with these documents than the jury got, and I'm kind of good with details and documents, and not, even in a group of 12 jurors, I'm not sure you'd find somebody who reads documents like I do. And so he's
right.
Not credible, and he is almost certainly one of these other people who brings stuff home.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're kind of one of a kind in an entire global blogosphere, Marcy. So it does make it difficult statistically when you're dealing with just 12 to glean those kind of details, no doubt about it. All right, when we get back, we got more with Marcy Wheeler on the conviction of Jeffrey Sterling for the leak to James Risen on the Merlin plot, the ridiculous Merlin plot. Back in just a moment. Emptywheel.net for her great blog. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Empty Wheel. That's what they call her on Twitter and at her blog, emptywheel.net. Here she is at salon.com. Oh, Marcy Wheeler is her actual human being name. Here she is at salon.com. Jeffrey Sterling, the CIA, and up to 80 years in prison on circumstantial evidence. And this is one of the major points of the piece here, is that the case, it seems like, Marcy, you're saying that they really made was that, yeah, Risen had talked to this guy, and this guy had talked to Risen. Nobody really knows what they talked about, but you could make a pretty strong, I think you're making a pretty strong circumstantial case that seems like Sterling might have given Risen a tip, maybe not have actually given him any classified information at all. Maybe just told him, hey, there's a thing called Merlin and some Iran nuke something, and you need to find out about it. Maybe not even that much, right? And you're saying that when the jury sustains this kind of a prosecution, then that sets a whole new precedent in the common law, basically, or whatever kind of law, that that's how the law is defined now, is by what the prosecutors got away with in the past. So they could now criminalize government sources for something that has never been criminal before. Am I reading you right?
Right. You know, because it's very common that if you want an investigative reporter, somebody who is as thorough and smart and well-sourced as James Rayson, to report on a classified topic without getting yourself in trouble, what you do is say, hey, Rayson, here's my unclassified performance review. Go figure out what the difficult asset that I was working with. And you're James Rayson. You've written an entire book about Russian intelligence. You've got really good sources in the CIA in that particular area. I believe that Rayson could put that together. You say, I'm going to go talk to the Senate Intelligence Committee. The first thing I would do if I were James Rayson is call the Senate Intelligence Committee. And in fact, one of the witnesses said he was called. The FBI made it very clear that the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee refused to cooperate still, to the end, with the FBI investigation. So they never actually went through and figured out whether anybody on the Senate Intelligence Committee had served as a Rayson source. That's what Rayson's story first looked like when he went to the CIA. And then over the course of 20 more days, he got things like a document, and he got some other materials. Again, Rayson's got a ton of sources in the CIA. But what's the most remarkable thing about this, and that's just a theory, okay? But what's remarkable to me is Rayson and Sterling had 4 minutes and 11 seconds of conversation in the period where the government says Sterling told them all about Merlin. 4 minutes and 11 seconds for it probably would have been a 1,000-word article in the New York Times. It's just not credible that Sterling gave him that information. It's far more credible that Sterling tipped him off and said, go look this up, and that Rayson managed to do that. And yet, based on that and based on the instructions to the jury said that Sterling could be found guilty if he either directly or indirectly provided Rayson information. So I'm wondering whether the jury believes telling Rayson that he was testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee and then somebody on the Senate Intelligence Committee leaking classified information counts as indirect passage of information. And also, even crazier, they took the language in the Espionage Act that says if you cause information to be leaked, basically, then you're guilty. And they argued that not only was – they argued successfully, right, that not only was Sterling responsible for leaking Rayson this information about Merlin, about this document involved in Merlin, about the Russian Merlin – but also that he was responsible for the New York Times deciding that they were going to try and write a story about it. James Rayson didn't have any responsibility. Jill Abramson, no responsibility. It was Sterling who caused that to happen. And then even crazier, Sterling caused all these secrets to be delivered back to Virginia in the form of a bound book in 2006. He caused that to happen, and therefore he's guilty on those charges. And that's the kind of expansion of the interpretation of the Espionage Act that I think people in D.C. need to be very wary of, because it means, and I don't know whether this is what happened in this case, that's my guess, it means that you can tip somebody off using completely unclassified information, and then no matter what the investigative reporter then does with your tip, because you caused that to happen, you're responsible. You can go to prison. I mean, I don't think that Sterling, I don't think he will be sent to prison for 80 years, which is what he could be. It's probably 40, 35, something in the area of Chelsea Manning. But remember, Chelsea Manning leaked hundreds of thousands of cables. Sterling leaked one story.
Yeah, and you're still so talking about a life sentence for a man in his 50s or 60s here, right?
He's 47.
Oh, okay. Well,
still.
But, you know, basically the rest of his life, or much of the rest of his life. For one story that he, you know, that on the first part of the story, to get to the New York Times article, I just don't see where he did it. I mean, I don't see, on the later, there were lots of conversations with Rayson that I might be more inclined to believe that, but 4 minutes, 11 seconds, going to prison for, you know, up to 80 years.
Yeah, that's really something else. And under a statute where it's just laughable on its face. You take any family at any kitchen table in America and say, a guy at the CIA tells a story of scandalous misbehavior at the CIA to the New York Times. Is that espionage? And they'll say, no. Espionage is working in the service of a foreign power to undermine your own country. Not telling the truth to the most official press in the entire nation about misdoings by our public servants? And what are they talking about?
Right.
I don't know how they get away with this at all. And this is conviction number 6 or 7 under this thing in just in the Obama years?
Well, Thomas Drake got off. So, yeah, it's something close to that. There was one other guy who got off with a plea deal that was pretty inconsequential. But it's got to be close to that.
And, I mean, they really are saying that we are the enemy. The American public are the enemy of the American government if they're telling secrets to us.
All the more so, because if you look at what was released as exhibits in trial, it became clear that they were not, the CIA was not hiding Merlin's identity from Iran. They had him writing under his own name. They had him writing under using his email address that he used at home. For the first 8 months of this operation, he was using the AOL account he shared with his family and kids, his wife and kids, if you believe that. I mean, I'm aghast. Like, I'm gonna send fake nuclear deals to Iran on the same AOL account my kids use to write their buddies. They had him, his post office box was somewhere close to where he lives in the New York area. I mean, so Iran knew exactly who this guy was. This entire operation was premised on the theory that Iran was closely cooperating with Russia, both real Russia and Russian dissidents. And so if that premise is correct, then Iran had all of the people they needed to go to say, who is this Mr. Merlin guy? Because we keep getting these weird emails from him. Mm-hmm. So Iran knew exactly who they were because for the same reasons. And because until Sterling came in, the CIA officer working with Merlin had horrible operational security, continued to meet with him at the same meeting place over and over again. The Russians would have known. I mean, you know, Russia likes to have spies in New York City. We know that. And if they really cared about tracking what this guy was doing, then they would know exactly what he was doing, and they would have good reason to believe that he was meeting with the CIA. So it's not like Merlin got exposed through James Rice's reporting to Iran and Russia. CIA told both of them what Merlin was up to, either directly or indirectly. It's us who learned a little bit about Merlin. That's it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, to read Norman Solomon, it seemed like the prosecution was as concerned with trying to deny the scandalous part of the Risen story as much as they were going after Sterling. They basically spent, you know, most of their time explaining why this operation was great and went off pretty much without a hitch and protecting themselves from embarrassment as if they're accountable.
I don't know if you saw, the Think has had an article saying, oh, this proves that Rice's book is wrong. And oddly enough, he cited this guy, Bob S.'s testimony. He was not in the courtroom, Pincus. And as far as I know, the transcript for Bob S.'s testimony has not been released. And what Pincus quotes from Bob S. is very partial. It doesn't, you know, Bob S. goes on to admit that Merlin wrote a letter. The CIA doesn't have copies of either the computer printed letter or the handwritten letter that Merlin left inside a newspaper at the IAEA, the Iranian mission. And so for some reason, somebody sent Pincus out to go reiterate that in the Washington Post. But Pincus, we're wrong. So I'm about to write a piece making fun of that.
Haha, that's funny. Yeah. And then
I'm going to write a longer piece about why this was such a mess. I mean, because I think evidence submitted at trial makes it very clear this was even a bigger problem than what Rison has in his book.
Yeah, it certainly looks like it. You know, Gareth, I don't know if you saw his piece for Middle East
Eye
about it, where he says that the CIA began pretending that they thought Iran had a nuclear weapons program right at the time when they were needing to justify the Merlin program. And it was the cart that came before the horse there, which was something that he had not figured out before, even though he wrote the book on it.
Right. I mean, and that's the other thing. I mean, we actually called Gareth from the courtroom because this Bob S. guy, and this is the nutty thing, is they revealed so much about what counterproliferation does. Ray McGovern called Gareth and said, you got to get down here. This is your beat. And he did. It was the CIA, and I did a post on this, the CIA, to to avenge Mr. Merlin, even though, as I said, we had already made it clear to the Iranians who he was, basically exposed a bunch more of their secrets that we otherwise wouldn't know, including that Mrs. Merlin, Merlin's wife, was also a CIA asset and was between one and the both of them. They were CIA assets all the way up until 2009, so long after they said that they had stopped having any value. Secrets, right? CIA spilled those secrets because they need vengeance against Jeffrey Sterling for making CIA look bad.
Right. Well, that's because there's two standards.
Right.
All right. Well, I've kept you over time there, Marcy, but thank you very much for staying with us. I appreciate it. Great interview.
Great to talk to you, Scott.
Great work. All right, y'all. That's Marcy Wheeler. She's at emptywheel.net and on Twitter at emptywheel. See you tomorrow.